Musikang Bayan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Climate justice activists are preparing for a major march and rally in Glasgow Saturday, calling on world leaders to do more to address the climate emergency. Speakers will include some of the most prominent youth climate activists, including Greta Thunberg of Sweden, Vanessa Nakate of Uganda, and our next guest, Mitzi Tan of the Philippines. Last Friday, she
rallied KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a web and new media coordinator. Our web and new media coordinator is responsible for KBOO's website and social media accounts. Applicants should have experience administering a CMS such as Drupal and experience administering a MySQL database, including backups and queries. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Applications are due by November 17th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel. Sacrifice zone for the 1% in their green zones.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be. To be or not to be,
to be engaged in this existential struggle.
To be or not to be,
between life on earth and an economic model, or to take arms against a rising sea of troubles, and by opposing them from the ground up.
Public service announcement by the Axis of Dissent on behalf of the 99%.
We'll take our power from the wind and sun
and leave the oil in the ground.
Demand clean air and fresh clean water
and leave the oil in the ground.
And we'll be singing die, 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 die.
All along the
along the barricades.
All along the barricades.
The empire of fossil fuel has had it far too good
for far too long.
But all things must pass. All things decay.
Starting today.
The lack of separation between state and corporation. So die neoliberalism, miasma capitalism. Die. Die, capitalism must die. Die.
Yes, sirree, die, capitalism must die. I guess that's one of the themes of the show today. Thank you, Dambert, No Bacon, and the Axis of Dissent. From up in northern Washington State, like our guest for this show, who we'll bring up in just a second, my old friend Patrick Mazza will be talking about, this Glasgow summit that's going on now with 300 misleaders of the world jetted in on their private jets to, as Greta Thunberg says, blah, 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 blah. Well, but maybe something good can come of it. We'll see. Maybe. But we're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about kind of some things you might not have been thinking about or hearing much about. Some contradictions within the fossil fuel production system itself that will be complicating things perhaps even more than they're already complicated. So let me introduce Patrick. Patrick, as I said, is an old friend of mine. We were involved in the Portland Alliance. Anybody out there remember the Portland Alliance? A great alternative newspaper here in Portland. He was one of the first people that I knew that was really taking seriously the climate issue back, gosh, in the early mid-90s, and actually formed helped form his own organization around that. He had one of the early websites talking about the environmental issues and other issues in the Pacific Northwest called Cascadia Planet. I neglected to put on the website that he's got his own blog now, but he can talk about that. He was a member of the Delta 5, which conducted an oil train tripod blockade on the BNSF Everett Delta Yard in 2014. That's a rail freight rail yard up in Washington, and was able to argue the first climate civil disobedience necessity defense in a U.S. courtroom in 2016. He's been active with 350 Seattle since 2014 and served as a community solutions work group co-facilitator and was formerly served as board president. With that, good morning, Patrick. Patrick, are you with us? Something's going on. Maybe we lost him momentarily. So we'll either have to bring up the music again. It's just so great to hear Danbert No Bacon again. I used to play.
Here I am.
Oh, no.
Can you hear me now?
Yep. No worries. Good to hear you, Patrick. How are you doing this morning?
Yeah, I inadvertently had the mute button on, so I'm unmuted now, and here I am.
Right.
Good to be back, Paul.
Yeah, those mute and unmute buttons can get us into trouble.
Yeah.
Good to be with you again. I was looking on my Wednesday Talk Radio page and saw that I haven't had you on my show since 2016, Actually, you were on the steps of the state capitol in Olympia with a bunch of hunger strikers. God, 5 years has been a long time.
Are you sure? I seem to remember.
I thought there was another time. Anyway, I'll have to look better. But because I think we had a kind of a more sort of personal, casual conversation also about. I remember talking to you about you have been one of the people who kind of flagged the climate issue early on. You're kind of precocious in some ways. And I felt bad that I hadn't at that time picked up on it, as so many people hadn't. I mean, I'm talking the activist community, that, you know, we were kind of slow to get going on that. And of course, things have only gotten from bad to worse since then. You would probably agree.
Oh, yeah.
So, what do you think about that Danbert? I kind of wanted to leave that Danbert No Bacon song. I don't know if you did. You hear that song?
Yeah. That was pretty fun. Yeah, it definitely was fun. And yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, and the message of that song, you know, capitalism is kind of a box we're in, and you know, it seems that so many of our problems are just insoluble within that box. You know, a system devoted to, you know, that has private profit and wealth accumulation at its center is not exactly the system that's going to preserve life on planet Earth, or at least, you know, at least life as we know it. So, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I just wanted to...
The whole question is what we replace it with and how that's even possible.
Those are the fundamental. What is to be done, as Vladimir Lenin so famously said and wrote, and things at another time and age. But so there's so many things to talk about. You know, I kind of wanted to flag this Nafiz Ahmed's article, "Oil System Collapsing So Fast It May Derail Renewables," warn French government scientists. It kind of, as I kind of alluded to, it adds a whole other wrinkle. And, you know, I hope you can help us suss out the, you know, the meaning of that as we go along. It basically says that there's sort of a wind. What I got out of it is there's a sort of window. You know, people are talking about the Green New Deal. You know, people, you know, starting 5 years ago or whenever it was, people talked about the need for a war, World War II style, momentum, mobilization to switch from fossil fuels to renewables. There's various metaphors, you know, to talk about this need for there's the just transition movement. But he says essentially that there's a window of an opportunity to because producing renewables at this time requires not just a capitalist economy, because that's the economy that we're in, but it requires fossil fuels, because factories are still running largely on fossil fuels. So in order to make the transition happen, we have to essentially use up whatever fossil fuels we're going to end up using up before it all comes crashing down, if that's what's going to happen. And he says that there's contradictions within the fossil fuel economy. But I want to hold that off on that just a little bit, because I think that's a really important discussion. But I just want to sort of get your long view. I know you've been following this stuff for so long. You know, we're on COP26, of course, as Conference of Parties. And you know, as Greta Thunberg said, blah, 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 it seems to be mostly what happens at those things. But, you know, there's been Copenhagen, there's been Paris, there's been these sort of voluntary offers of commitments to reduce fossil fuels, which obviously didn't go anywhere. There's been, you know, commitments to transfer wealth to the so-called third world. You can't really call it the third world, you know, it's developing or whatever, you know, poorer countries, to allow them, you know, who are suffering the brunt of climate change, to allow them to develop their own infrastructure ability, et cetera, et cetera. And that hasn't happened. They're finally talking about that, some of them. So anyway, talk. But, you know, do you see anything happening, you know, out of this COP26, or is it just another exercise in futility?
It really is hard to see anything approaching what we need to have happen. I mean, you know, the Earth Summit was about 30 years ago, And that led up to the first Conference of the Parties, COP, the COP, which was in 95. Well, since the Earth Summit, half of all the greenhouse gases that are up there now that humans have released, we've released them since. You know, and you look at that chart, the parts per million of carbon dioxide that is taken at the station at Mauna Loa in Hawaii, and it relentlessly curves upward, even curves upward a little bit more nowadays. So what has all this blah 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 done? It doesn't seem to have done that much. I mean, the world is still expanding fossil fuel production, still exploring, still building coal-fired power plants, still building gas-fired power plants, still expanding highways, including in our supposedly progressive cities and states like Portland and Seattle and Oregon and Washington. I mean, the business-as-usual economy continues to go on, and we're really not seeing the kind of changes we need to see. So, you know, how much of this is, you know, I mean, we'll see some, you know, what they've gotten so far is methane reduction, which at COP, which amounts to subsidizing the fossil fuel industry to reduce its methane emissions, and supposedly a pledge to end deforestation by 2030. You know, I mean, those kind of pledges, you know, I guess I could pledge to lose 50 pounds by 2030, but I probably won't. And it's hard to see, you know, with all the interests that are pushing for example, rainforest destruction in Brazil, all the agricultural interests, that, you know, how is that really going to happen? So, you know, do we have solutions coming out of the COP? I wish I could say we do. I don't want to be totally negative, but you know, there's reasons for skepticism based on what we've seen so far.
Well, not to mention the evidence of our senses. I mean, you experienced that heat dome last summer. I mean, you know, it's already, you know, we got cool weather, and thankfully the rain has come back. I don't know if you had serious drought up there, but it was starting to get on my nerves. I imagine other people's nerves here in Portland, which, you know, usually doesn't go too many days or weeks without some rainfall, at least to just settle the dust, if nothing else. But yeah, so, you know, we're probably forgetting about it already, but that was dire. And, you know, the wildfires, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, and it's we're definitely seeing it. You know, that's the thing. It's so clear around the world. We're seeing the stages of really discernible intense climate impacts. Radical climate change is not something that's happening in the future. It's something that's with us now. You know, you see many more heat spikes, many more floods, and definite correlation. I mean, scientifically correlated with the increase of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, the increase of heat. You know, we're seeing lots of destruction, and yet, you know, the business as usual economy continues to go on, because again, it's capitalism. It's driven by the bottom line, and that value of money overall is not getting us there. You know, so we talked in the past. You know, I've talked about it too, about how we could have a greener economy and, you know, new technologies, and, you know, have, you know, businesses and money and jobs, and, you know, that's a piece of it, but it's, you know, but it can't be the driving force. The driving force has to be some, you know, commitment to some value, you know, some set of, I don't know, higher values or deeper values, but, you know, something beyond money in the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And we're just not seeing it because, you know, let's face it, our political system is broken. And you know, Biden's over in Glasgow, you know, apologizing for the U.S. being out of, for Trump pulling out of Paris, and they're back in. But, you know, look at what happened in Virginia yesterday. Republican won. Look at what happened in New Jersey. A Democrat is barely, you know, probably will bring off the governorship, but barely. I mean, I think a lot of people feel like, you know, the Republicans are gonna come back in 2022, and who knows what the 2024. Biden's poll numbers are kind of at a record low for a president at this time. So anything, you know, what, you know, any commitment the U.S. makes right now at Glasgow is, you know, people over there can look at our politics and know that, hey, you know, it might not be worth the paper it's written on. So, and our political system is ruled by money, and it's ruled by money and concentrated media. Our corporate system, I mean, you look at the unprecedented level of concentration in every industry. It becomes more and more concentrated all the time, and the levers of power get harder to access. So,
yeah, well,
I'm not being very encouraging here.
But, well, let's talk about you know, politics with a small p as well, as I like to say it. And I think a depressingly few number of people understand politics in that way. I guess, you know, look at the insurrectionists, you know, on January 6th, they understood the political power from, you know, direct action, and you know, there have been times in U.S. history when the left has understood mass direct action politics, which is really the only way that I can see where, you know, but the left is, even on the capital P political situation, where you do have, you know, grassroots people, that's what I consider small p politics, you know, ground up action, community-based action, people taking various forms of direct action. They can be, you know, boycotts, they can be strikes, they can be civil disobedience, they can be even something more than that, which is sometimes taboo for public discussion, but the infiltration of, you know, the kind of Sanderista type of approach, which, you know, he's been pretty coherent on through the years, Bernie Sanders, and he did mobilize a lot of people into the electoral political system, and helped, you know, in addition to sort of just the Black Lives Matter, et cetera, no DAPL resurgence of people power over the past 10 years. And the progressive wing of the party, which is, you know, forcing some of these, you know, big struggles that are happening in Congress that are, you know, really complicated. You know, you can blame it all on Manchin, and certainly Joe Manchin is an odious, particularly odious figure, toady of the capitalist fossil fuel class. But, you know, it's basically, there isn't enough power there in Congress to push through even, you know, watered down versions of some kind of transformational politics, transition politics, et cetera. And the left on the outside of the electoral arena is still terribly divided. I guess where I'm getting to is I've thought for a long time, and I think I've talked to you about this, I think basically the lack of publicly talking about our own contradictions and tensions and addressing them head on, primary among which is the capitalist, you know, can we actually make the kind of changes we want under a capitalist system, or can't we? I mean, that's like a fundamental question that people don't seem to want to talk about. So I want to introduce that. I mean, I have on my program page a little, you know, I went to the youth climate strike a few weeks ago and I had my sign. It is impossible to maintain a capitalist militarist economy and a livable climate at the same time. And I was kind of gratified. I got quite a few young folks coming up and saying, oh, great sign. Oh, I like your sign, like your sign. It was kind of cool, you know, but we didn't have any real in-depth opportunity to have a real in-depth discussions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so there, you know, the idea that there is a fundamental contradiction between the way we live and, you know, the basic fabric of the biosphere of our ecosystems is a hard one to get our hands around. But I just want to add in the other contradiction that I brought about and really get into that about the idea that there the ability to actually make this transition happen within a capitalist framework to produce enough renewables fast enough to be able to take the place of the fossil fuel production infrastructure, which is basically what we're facing. You know, it's just not going to work unless we have enough, fast enough, that transition can happen. It's being cast into doubt by this article, as I said. And other people, you sent me another article that sort of reinforces that argument, how much of the worsening energy crisis is due to depletion. And I'll just read the first paragraph and then hand it over to you to kind of go into it deeper, because I know you've been following this a lot deeper. A team of French government energy scientists are warning that the collapse of the global oil system is coming so rapidly it could derail the transition to a renewable energy system if it doesn't happen fast enough. In just 13 years, global oil production could enter into a terminal and exponential decline accompanied by the overall collapse of the global oil and gas industries over the next three decades. But this is not because the Earth is running out of oil and gas. Rather, it's because they are increasingly eating themselves to stay alive. The oil and gas industries are consuming exponentially more and more energy just to keep extracting oil and gas. That's why they've entered a downward spiral of increasing cost of production, diminishing profits, rising debt, and irreversible economic decline. The implication is that global energy shortages and price spikes will be a taste of things to come if we stay dependent on fossil fuels. Yet a growing narrative has instead wrongly pinpointed the clean energy transition as the culprit. Enough of a start. So go into this a little more deeply.
So what they're talking about is energy return on investment. You know, it used to be able to poke a drill in the ground and get to pools of oil, you know, that are relatively easy to get at, and it didn't take a lot of energy to get the energy. You know, it was a few percent, and that keeps going. As cheap and easy oil and gas reserves have gone away, you know, it's become more difficult. So you have to drill deeper. You have to frack, which costs more. You have to go out deeper in the ocean. So it's taking more and more energy to get energy. So that those authors, you know, basically came up with that right now, 15% of all the energy being produced is being put back into the production process. So that keeps going up, and they projected, in that 13-year, maybe will go up to 25%. So, you know, obviously the more energy it takes to get energy, the more expensive it gets. And what you're seeing, you're seeing some global energy, shocks and bottlenecks right now. And, you know, how much of that is specific failures of just the production system, and how much is this broader issue of depletion? I mean, there is a broader issue of depletion. So it gets down to investment. Are the oil gas industry is it making the investments to go find that that additional oil and gas? Well, it kind of, you know, they're making less investments now because, you know, because of what they see. You know, there's the prices, you know, fluctuate up and down, so they don't have the investment certainty they need. And the fracking industry itself has been a big Ponzi scheme. I mean, they, you know, we used to talk about peak oil, and in fact, conventional oil did peak as we expected in around 2005. And what's made up the difference, a lot of it has been fracking, you know, fracked oil, fracked gas. The thing is that that industry has never made money. You know, it's been a place where, you know, where speculative capital, which the world is full of, has flowed to, but it has been kind of a Ponzi scheme. And that is, you know, that and so what you're not seeing is a lot of new investment in the U.S. fracking industry. So that it's all, you know, it's all cascading, and you know, and it does look like, you know, what was projected back in the 70s, one of the articles I shared with you was looking at the trajectory of the Limits to Growth report, which came out in the 70s, the computer projections, which showed that at a certain point, this economy is going to begin to eat itself, and we're going to get into places where it just can't grow because resources have become more expensive, or pollution has become too great, the impacts, and the thing is, back in the 70s when that first came out, it was were having oil shocks then, food price shocks, and so it got some traction then, but then when things kind of leveled off in the 80s, people said, that was just full of crap, you know, we can keep growing. But what wasn't appreciated then was that the scenarios pointed to about this time as when the curves would begin to eat each other. The late 2010s, the early 2020s are where, you know, things were supposed to get crunchy. And they've gotten crunchy. I mean, what right now, you know, one of the factors that's restricting the growth of global solar is the supply chain collapse. There's just difficulties in the global supply chain, which for the first time solar is starting to increase in price. And so you see all these kind of contradictions and curves eating each other, and you know, I mean, I guess at one level, it's, you know, if you accept the fact that we can't infinitely grow on a finite planet, yeah, you know, let's face up to these facts right now.
Let me just reintroduce ourselves. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio, the program you are listening to. And I'm speaking with my guest, Patrick Mazza from Seattle, longtime journalist, writer, activist, been tracking the climate and talking about the climate movement, all issues climate, for decades now. And he's been involved with the 350 Seattle since 2014. And we're talking about the Conference of the Parties, the big shindig in Glasgow, where, as I said, 400 private jets ushered our global misleaders to their big get together. And six years, fun fact, 6 years since the Paris Climate Accords. There have been the six hottest years on record. There's a fun fact.
Right, right.
And I invite, this is a call-in show. We've taken up half the show already. And so now is your turn as your listeners to grab your phones and call up 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. That's the number to talk to our board operator and talk to us. And you better do it soon. Don't wait till the last 5 minutes. That doesn't work very well for us right. or for you. So yeah, let me, this guy, Nafiz Ahmed, I assume you followed him somewhat. He's been writing some of the more cogent analyses. I actually tried to get him on for this show and for another show, and I haven't never heard back from him. Hopefully I will someday. But he wrote a book called Failing States, Collapsing Systems, along with a systems ecologist, Professor Charles Hall, who pioneered these energy return on investment measurements, which are how much energy you must use to extract energy for a given resource or technology, which, as they say, is, and you said, 15.5%, more than a tenth of the energy produced from oil worldwide is already necessary to keep producing all the oil, yet this is getting worse, not better, since the production of the easiest to get conventional oil slowed down and plateaued around 15 years ago, which you mentioned also. We're increasingly relying on forms of difficult to extract unconventional oil that uses greater amounts of energy for more complex techniques like fracking. In 1950, this is important, the energy return on investment of global oil production was really high at about 44-1 ratio rather than less than 10-1. Meaning for every unit of energy we put in, we're getting a whopping 44 out. Yet as a graph he illustrates in this excellent article, this value has undergone a shockingly steep decline. By 2020, it reached around 8-1 and is projected to decline and plateaued around 6.7 from 2040 onwards. Anyway, and so this is a very somewhat technical but really important discussion, and I think very overlooked discussion of some of the, you know, we're talking about contradictions between economy and ecology. Well, this is it. This gets into the nitty-gritty of it. So let's go to our first caller. James, you're on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I really appreciate this conversation. You know, I think it's really interesting how right now, you know, with the talk of the Green New Deal, that, you know, we don't have at least a lot more talk in what we would consider leftist circles about, you know, what pushed the original New Deal. And it wasn't that FDR was some benevolent, you know, benefactor who wanted to do the right thing. It's that he had a base of people pushing him to do the thing that they wanted, or they were going to, you know, push revolution. And I just, I don't know. It's like, it seems like everybody wants to, you know, I understand that everybody wants to find the peaceful solution, but I mean, even looking at what the New Deal brought and how it literally only took about 50 years to undo because there was such a huge, there's such a huge backlash from the community of people that the money was taken from. And I just, I don't know. I see people trying to push reforms as if the system just needs to be, you know, the system is just, it's just being run the wrong way. You know, it's kind of like, you know, repairing a car that's on its way to be tossed out versus repairing a car that's worth being repaired. And I just you know, feel like with the indoctrination that we have, it's like we're looking at it in the wrong way. And I don't know. My frustration is that it's like we can't repair a system that wasn't made for us to begin with. So it's instead of, you know, so I feel like, I don't know, I guess what's your take? Because, like, I feel like we can't put, like, I'm all for pushing reforms if the reforms lead to revolution. Because that's ultimately where I feel like we should go. But I feel like everybody right now is pushing reforms just for reforms.
Yeah, you know, I write I have a blog called The Raven. theraven.substack.com, and I'm preparing my next piece I'm working on is titled is the U.S. Beyond Repair, and so many of us, I mean, even progressive people, you know, kind of tend to more radical thinking people, we still desperately want our political system to work. And everything is telling us that our that it's just too locked up in interest. That this complex of hyper concentrated media, political funders, it really is making reformist solutions impossible. So where do we go? I mean, I wrote a piece, a few weeks back, basically saying, I titled it, "If We Don't Get Climate Justice, Shut It Down." And I think kind of that's where we need to be thinking about going. I'm a veteran of Seattle 99, when we shut down Seattle for the WTO. I also was back in Washington, D.C., going to school in ancient times back in 1971 when we had the May Day demonstrations, which shut down Washington, D.C. for a week. It's not well remembered, but it was the largest civil disobedience arrests in U.S. history, over 12,000 people. I was one of them. And I think that that's kind of where we need to go, to just say, shut this thing down. One in all the bad political news, one of the really encouraging developments is more labor activism. You see the John Deere strike. There is an upsurge of, and that's, so fundamental, the contradiction between labor and capital. So, there's a recent book, Andreas Malm, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which is recommending property destruction, which I know that's a hotly contested topic, but yeah, it's looking like the system is unfixable and is locking in, at the federal level. The Supreme Court is bad and it's probably going to get worse. The Congress is going to go back to the Republicans. We're probably going to get a hard right, Republican administration in 2024. It might be Trump returning or maybe somebody worse. So I think really, one of the things, we want to believe in our system. We still, so many of us still want to believe it, but I think it's time to say, we can't believe in it anymore.
We got another caller, and I just want to invite other people to call in. I have about 15 minutes left, 503-231-8187. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. Recently had our fall fun drive. We'd still like you to encourage, if you like what you're hearing, to contribute to our station, KBOO.FM. Go there. We've got, a new hoodie. We've got a T-shirt. And just the satisfaction of knowing that you can keep the sounds of democracy alive, the people's radio going here on the Boo. Let's go to Camilo's next in line. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for this discussion. It is exactly where we are, exactly where we need to be. And the way that I view it, this discussion takes us to the intersection of the institutional forces, the systemic forces, and our personal commitments, our personal attitudes. And, while it's the systemic issues that are really determinative of outcome, I think that we who are engaged have to examine ourselves. And this is what I see as the dilemma, and I indicate myself as a perfect exemplar. I'm a retired bourgeois with a leftist soul and heart that relies on a capitalist portfolio to take me until my last days. And, while I believe in what you're saying about the necessity for this revolution, I rely on the institution. And I wonder, how do we reconcile the fact that the kind of efforts that we as individuals, as activists, make are so small compared to the scale of institutional change that's necessary. How do we deal with this as individuals?
There's a big question for you. I share that. I actually, full confession, I'm, living with my elderly mother, and I'm dependent upon her capitalist portfolio that her husband invested in. When one could do such things on a decent salary, you could actually, there's a lot of a dwindling number of people out there, and people who are in that situation, and people who have come behind, are not in such a favorable situation. It's one of the other contradictions of our system as it sort of cannibalizes itself, but neoliberalism, that is. So all I can say, my response is, is small movements that I've been part of that had an outsized impact, and no one could possibly have known from the beginning what the trajectory might have been. I'm talking in particular about the forest protection movement and Earth First here in the Northwest, and a movement against a high-speed train in Italy in the 2000s that turned into a very influential movement, actually, even I think maybe globally, but very not known well or understood. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, how to leverage those? And I think that was what was exciting for me about the 80s and 90s. That
I would like to comment on what you said, Paul, because yeah. I think it's important. And the way I hear what you're saying is that faith is really the necessity of making an effort, and I believe that.
Well, the faith of just living and getting enthusiastic, continuing to be able to get enthusiastic in spite of everything. I mean, we were all young then. I'm talking about most of the people in this movement. And so, yeah, we were kind of going on, maybe an unconscious faith, the faith of just life itself and just trying new things and just throwing ourselves at whatever. But yeah, so just to cut a long story short is the task then that some of us began to understand and helped lead to that, the Seattle of 99, which, had a limited impact globally, but it had a certain impact. But was a model for how different strands of different small groupings of people, each getting their own independent momentum, the anti-sweatshops movement, the forest protection movement, a bunch of different movements, all coalescing and realizing that the problem was, global capitalism. Globalism, as we called it, but it was global capitalism. And realizing that these large structures of power where like the WTO and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, et cetera, and places where these people congregate, and now they're congregating in Glasgow. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, it didn't didn't lead to revolution at the time. Some of us did start to hope, to dream of something like revolutionary transformation, but it was nobody, nobody since, I guess, I don't know, I mentioned Lenin, since the revolutionaries that actually succeeded in taking state power in large states, nobody since those days, which seem to have largely gone by, have really come up with the kind of relatively simple formula for taking power when it's become so vast and complex. So yeah, that's my only take. So what do you think, Patrick?
Well, I think I think there's a point for just standing up for what is right. That we through history, people have faced really large obstacles, stubborn institutions, very dark times, and just at a certain level, just to be a, you know, just to be a human being, you got to just stand up for what's right. And, you know, and there, whatever the prospect of victory or defeat. And also, you know, I think we got to look at, you know, the power of the system is great, but but the system itself is so rife with contradictions that fewer and fewer people actually do believe in it. So, you know, things can happen really quickly. I mean, you know, we're coming up on an anniversary year in December of the Soviet Union falling very suddenly. You know, and that was a system which people didn't believe in anymore. And it just kind of fell apart from the inside. And I think just to be out there, to be saying what is right, what we need to do. And yeah, you know, we're all relying on the system itself. You know, some of us have retirement accounts, some of us don't. But yeah, I mean, just, you know, get, you know, we're kind of locked into it, just getting by on what we, you know, what we can do and live with our own contradictions. But, you know, I think ultimately it's just the human soul. You just got to stand up for what you believe in. And
well, on that note, let's see what our next caller, Brian, yeah, has to say. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. So I've been in and around activism, stuff like that. I grew up in a relatively working-class family. I worked on docks as a kid, you know, got forced out of my house, went in the military. But what I have seen in the last 10 years is this real, and that earlier caller, James, I think, spoke to this more, is this complete disconnect from working class. Doesn't matter what, you know, race, whatever, but the disconnect from the working class. And I can speak to that in going to some early, and I went to some Earth First things, climate convergence actions. And about 10 years ago, I started seeing this trend where when we're at these convergences, working alongside other working class people, I would go and hang out at a bar or some social setting with it. And other activists would be like, how can you hang out with those people? Like, they couldn't connect on just a language and just connect with them and create a relationship. It was their talk was so divisive and just jumping to the most radical thing possible as the only solution. It's this, like, we have to have a revolution for there to be any change. And my thing is, like, no. What I see going on in the last 10 years is we have a far right and a far left that are tearing the working class of America apart. Because I've gone down to some of the social justice things, and I can definitely say I was at and part of some of the earlier Black blocs like 10 years ago. What's going on now is straight up nihilism. These kids just want to go out there and smash everything, and that is not helping. It's not helping us at all. It's actually emboldening the right, is what I see. And then what we're dealing with now is tougher and tougher laws. And you brought it up, you know, the Green Scare that couple of, you know, years ago, that was very real. They passed laws and they started stooping everybody up. Obama got elected and everybody forgot about it. That's pretty much what I see is this, but there's this move to be like, oh, we have to be more radical. Well, and I feel like, no, the guys, we have to bring people together.
Well, I guess the question I have is on what basis, you know, it's like the missing middle, I guess, is what you're talking about. That there's a, you know, the working class I'm not sure.
I'll put it this way. I'll say at earlier Mayday rallies, I remember going to Mayday rallies in Portland that were huge, right, big ones. And then basically you start seeing stuff like the Black Bloc kids grabbing flags from union members and burning them and starting fist fights in the street. I'd go up and like, why are you doing that? And they literally had no philosophy around it. It was just straight up nihilism,
we got to burn all the flags because, you know, burn all the flags. And it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Like me, I can say that my family came from Italy, immigrated here, escaped fascism, went back over there and fought them. I can tell you, if somebody tried to burn my grandfather's flag, I would lose my freaking mind, dude. I would lose my mind.
Okay, well, we're running out of time. Thank you, Brian. I'll just turn it over to see what Patrick has to respond.
Well, I mean, it's definitely troubling. I mean, a lot of the working class feels just completely alienated and is not being addressed by the left, and so they slip to the right, and I think we definitely need a politics that addresses economics, that looks at different economic alternatives, and that actually provides answers. I think we need to talk about cooperative enterprises, public enterprises, social housing, stuff that actually addresses people's lives.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, and we do have one last caller who I think probably might want to address some of the questions that Brian brought up and perhaps some of the previous ones, but need to keep it short. Go ahead, Joe.
I had only caught the caller before last and was calling initially to respond to him, but the other caller kind of started to bark up the tree I wanted to. But I wanted to be more specific to the question, like, how do we bridge the gap between individual and institutional power? And Brian talked about kind of like the alienation and the way that we don't bring people together. And there's this, you know, concern, I think, with a lot of people who are so alienated from members of their family, members of their workplace, members of their neighborhood, feeling like there are these unbridgeable ideological gaps between them that make communicating over anything else impossible. And I want to challenge everybody to get to know your neighbors, to get to know your coworkers, to talk to people about what matters to both of you, to more people in your community, and to not be afraid of the conflict, to not be afraid of the disagreement. There's obviously like those extreme situations, especially with people who are already marginalized or oppressed, where no, a black person doesn't have to go tell the Nazi why they should consider their mutual interests. But there are many, many places in society where we do not have a constituency. And when we talk about institutional power, we are talking about constituencies wielding it. And so individuals don't wield institutional power. If they do, they're dictators or they go crazy. We have to build constituencies based off of our lived communities, the communities that we're already in, and not necessarily these self-selecting activist groups, as important as they are to the ecology of the movement. The movements that actually tried to change the world 100 years ago were built by people who were working alongside their neighbors and coworkers, and that's it.
Okay, we do have to wind down. Quick last word. We have about 10 to 20 seconds, Patrick.
Yeah, just a plug for my Substack, theraven.substack.com, writing about some of this stuff, trying to find some political ways through. And it ain't easy, but we're working on it.
Okay. Well, thank you. I guess we have a little bit more time, but I just want to again mention this. I think really I'm going to put it on my program page. I didn't initially. I wasn't sure exactly how much we'd be talking about it, but on the Byline Times, Nahfiz Ahmed, who is, as I said, I think one of the more acute observers on the scene. Oil system collapsing so fast it may derail renewables, warn French government scientists, which add a new wrinkle to the debate over whether we can actually whether the system's going to collapse first, or the climate will collapse first, or it seems to all be collapsing simultaneously. But his point is again that in order to actually make the transition happen, we have to use the existing capitalist. Well, he doesn't say this explicitly, but if we don't do it, if we don't use the remaining oil to produce enough renewables to make the transition happen, the fossil fuel system is just going to continue to cannibalize itself because of the difficulty of getting the last oil and gas out of the ground. So just want to have people check that article out and talk about it. And I guess we're out of time. Thank you, Patrick. Been really good talking with you.
You too. You too, Paul. Thank you.
To be or not to be, to be or not to be.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows and reaper drones of those who make outrageous fortunes from the suicide bomb of fossil fuel.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation